is something that is nascent in themselves, but that they have not yet brought into being. That, the fact that it is still in the nascent and unrecognized stage in themselves, is the real reason why they admire it in others. Once they have begun to bring these characteristics forth in themselves, they will begin to admire something different in others in order to continue the cycle of growth into inner freedom and happiness. Knowing what you admire in others is a wonderful mirror into your deepest as yet unborn self. These suggestions were intriguing, and I was reading stacks of books about various figures, but I didn't feel a particular affinity for anyone until I came across Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. I'd become interested in Saint Thérèse after I saw her praised in Thomas Merton's memoir, The Seven-Story Mountain. I'd been so surprised to see the cranky, monkish Merton write reverently about the sappily named Little Flower that I was curious to read her spiritual memoir, Story of a Soul. That book fascinated me so much that, without quite realizing it, I developed a mini-obsession with Saint Thérèse. I bought one book about her, and then another, and then another. I read Story of a Soul several times. One day, as he saw me trying to cram my latest Saint Thérèse biography onto the shelf, between The Hidden Face of Saint Thérèse and Two Portraits of Saint Thérèse, Jamie asked with a note of disbelief in his voice, "How many books about Saint Thérèse are you going to buy?" There are few topics that would interest Jamie less than the life of a Catholic saint. I looked with surprise at the shelf and counted the biographies, histories, and analyses of Saint Thérèse. I'd bought 17, and I'd read every single one. I also had a videotape and a used book that was nothing but Saint Thérèse photographs, for which I'd paid $75. Indulge in a modest splurge. Light dawned. I had a spiritual master. Saint Thérèse was my spiritual master. But why was I attracted to this Catholic saint, a French woman who had died at the age of 24 after having spent 9 years cloistered with some 20 nuns? Saint Thérèse, the Little Flower, known for her little way. After I thought about it for 5 seconds, it became perfectly obvious. I'd started my happiness project to test my hypothesis that I could become happier by making small changes in my ordinary day. I didn't want to reject the natural order of my life by moving to Walden Pond or Antarctica, say, or taking a sabbatical for my husband. I wasn't going to give up toilet paper or shopping or experiment with hallucinogens. I'd already switched careers. Surely, I'd hoped, I could change my life without changing my life by finding more happiness in my own kitchen. Everyone's happiness project is different. Some people might feel the urge to make a radical transformation. I was vicariously exhilarated by these dramatic adventures, but I knew they weren't the path to happiness for me. I wanted to take little steps to be happier as I lived my ordinary life, and that was very much in the spirit of Saint Thérèse. Thérèse Martin was born in Alençon, France, in 1873. Before her parents' marriage, her father had tried to become a monk and her mother a nun, but both had been rejected by religious orders. Her 5 sisters, who survived childhood, all became nuns, and Thérèse became a saint. Thérèse tried to enter a Carmelite convent at Lisieux at age 15. 2 of her sisters were already there. But the bishop wouldn't permit it because she was too young. She traveled to Rome to ask Pope Leo XIII's permission personally, but the pope stood by the bishop's decision. Then the bishop changed his mind. When Thérèse was in the convent, her mother was her older sister Pauline, who instructed Thérèse to write the story of her childhood, which became the basis of Story of a Soul. In 1897, at the age of 24, Thérèse died an agonizing death from tuberculosis. While she lived, no one outside her family and convent had heard of Thérèse. After she died, an edited version of her memoir was sent to Carmelite convents and church officials as an obituary notice. Just 2,000 copies were printed initially, but the popularity of this springtime story of a little white flower, as she'd characteristically titled it, spread with astonishing rapidity. Just 2 years after her death, her grave had to be placed under guard to protect it from pilgrims seeking relics. It's hard to understand how such a short, modest account of childhood and youth could have such spiritual power. Yet, of course, I feel it myself. Accordingly, in a suspension of the ordinary requirements, Thérèse got a fast-track canonization in 1925 and became Saint Thérèse just 28 years after her death. To mark the centenary of her death, in 1997, Pope John Paul II made her a Doctor of the Church, the elite category of 33 super saints that includes St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. To me, the fascinating aspect of her story was Thérèse's achievement of sainthood through the perfection of small, ordinary acts. That was her little way, holding this achieved in a little way by little souls rather than by great deeds performed by great souls. Love proves itself by deeds, so how am I to show my love? Great deeds are forbidden me. The only way I can prove my love is by every little sacrifice, every glance and word, and the doing of the least actions for love. There was nothing outwardly striking about Thérèse's life or her death. She lived an obscure existence, much of it without stepping foot outside her convent. And though she was born just 1 year before Churchill, while she was dying in the convent infirmary, he was fighting as part of the Malakand Field Force in British India, she seems like a figure from the distant, quaint past. Thérèse didn't overcome a dysfunctional family or monumental difficulties. She had loving parents and a tender, indulgent upbringing in prosperous circumstances. Although Thérèse confided in Story of a Soul that, "I want to be a warrior, a priest, an apostle, a doctor of the church, a martyr. I should like to die on the battlefields in defense of the church." She didn't perform outstanding feats or undertake daring adventures. Indeed, except for her trip to petition the Pope, she stayed in her neighborhood and with her immediate family for her whole life. She wanted to suffer and to spill her blood for Jesus, and she did, but in a little way, not in a glorious confrontation in war or at the stake, but by dying in agony, spitting up blood as a pitiful tuberculosis victim. As Pope Pius XI emphasized in the Bull of Canonization, Thérèse achieved heroic virtue without going beyond the common order of things. Reading about Thérèse taught me a lot about bulls of canonization and all the mechanics of saint-making. I couldn't aspire to Thérèse's saintliness, but I could follow her by aspiring to perfection within the common order of my day. We expect heroic virtue to look flashy, moving to Uganda to work with AIDS victims, perhaps, or documenting the plight of homeless people in Detroit. Thérèse's example shows that ordinary life, too, is full of opportunities for worthy, if inconspicuous, virtue. One of my favorite examples. Thérèse intensely disliked one of her fellow nuns, Teresa of St. Augustine, whom Thérèse described, without identifying her, as a sister who has the faculty of displeasing me in everything, in her ways, her words, her character. Instead of avoiding her, Thérèse sought out this nun at every turn and treated her as if I loved her best of all, so successfully that this sister once asked Thérèse, "Would you tell me what attracts you so much toward me? Every time you look at me, I see your smile." After Thérèse's death, when this disagreeable nun gave her testimony during the process of Thérèse's beatification, she said smugly, "At least I can say this much for myself. During her life, I made her really happy." Teresa of St. Augustine never knew that she was the unlikable sister mentioned in Story of a Soul until 30 years later, when the chaplain, in a fit of exasperation, told her the truth. It's a little thing, of course, but anyone who has ever suffered from a whiny coworker, a narcissistic roommate, or interfering in-laws can appreciate the heavenly virtue the befriending such a person would require. Because of my happiness research, one of the passages in Story of a Soul that most struck me was Thérèse's observation that, "For the love of God and my sisters, so charitable towards me, I take care to appear happy, and especially to be so." Thérèse succeeded so well at seeming effortlessly happy, and her laughter came so easily that many of her fellow nuns didn't recognize her virtue. One sister said, "Saint Thérèse gets no merit for practicing virtue. She has never had to struggle for it." Near the end of Thérèse's life, another sister observed that Thérèse made visitors to the infirmary laugh so much that, "I believe she will die laughing. She is so happy." At a time when Thérèse was in both secret spiritual torment and excruciating physical pain. Buddhists talk about skillful and unskillful emotions, and this has the right connotation of effort and competence. People assume that a person who acts happy must feel happy. But although it's in the very nature of happiness to seem effortless and spontaneous, it often takes great skill. I set out to imitate Thérèse by doing a better job of acting happy when I knew that my happiness would make someone else happy. I didn't want to be fake, but I could make an effort to be less critical. I could look for ways to be honestly enthusiastic about foods that weren't necessarily my favorite things to eat, activities that weren't my first choice, or movies, books, and performances with which I could find fault. Usually I could find something to praise. Also, I saw that I needed to make a bigger show of my happiness. For example, when my Kennedy biography came out, various family members asked questions that in retrospect I realized were meant to elicit responses from me, such as, "I'm so thrilled! It's so exciting to see it on the shelves! Everything is going great! I'm so happy!" But I have a perfectionist, dissatisfied, fretful, worrying nature, and I'm not easily thrilled. Looking back, I realized that the loving thing to do would have been to act happy, not only for myself, but also for them. I know how happy I am when one of them is very happy. How happy I was to hear Eliza say excitedly to my mother as they were setting up an elaborate tea party, "Bunny, this is so fun!" And to hear my mother say, "Yes, it is." As often happened with the Happiness Project, it was only once I vowed to stop criticizing and carping that I realized the strength of my instinct to criticize and carp. But for the love of my family and friends, so loving toward me, I tried to appear happy, and especially to be so. A worthy model closer to home than Thérèse was my father. Nicknamed Smilin' Jack Kraft by my sister's friends, one of his most lovable traits is that he is, or I should say he acts, unflaggingly cheerful and enthusiastic, and this makes a tremendous difference to everyone else's happiness. One day, not too long ago, when we were visiting Kansas City, my father came home from work, and my mother told him, "We're having pizza for dinner." My father answered, "Wonderful, wonderful. Do you want me to go pick it up?" I knew my father well enough to know that he'd answer that way even if he didn't want pizza for dinner, and even if the last thing he felt like doing was heading back out the door. This kind of unswerving enthusiasm looks easy, but when I tried to adopt that attitude myself, I realized how difficult it is. It is easy to be heavy, hard to be light. Acting happy, and even more, being happy, is challenging. Furthermore, and it took me a long time to accept this perverse fact, many people don't want to be happy, or at least don't want to seem happy. And if they act as if they're not happy, they're not going to feel happy. I'm not including depressed people in this category. Depression is a serious condition outside the happy-unhappy continuum. Whether in response to a particular situation, such as a job loss, or the death of a spouse, or an imbalance of chemicals in the brain, or some other cause, depression is its own beast. But many non-depressed people are unhappy, and some seem to want to be that way. Why? It turns out there are a lot of reasons. Happiness, some people think, isn't a worthy goal. It's a trivial American preoccupation, the product of too much money and too much television. They think that being happy shows a lack of values, and that being unhappy is a sign of depth. At a party, a guy said to me, "Everyone's too worried about being fulfilled. They're so self-indulgent. It's there in the Declaration of Independence, and people think they should be happy. Happiness isn't the point." "Well," I said, "now that our country has achieved a certain standard of prosperity, people set their goals on higher things. Isn't it admirable that people want to be happy? If happiness isn't the point, what is?" Working for goals like social justice, peace, or the environment is more important than happiness. "But," I ventured, "you think it's important to help other people, to work for the benefit of others. And of course it is. But why? Why worry about children living in poverty or malaria in Africa unless, at bottom, it's because you want people to be healthy, safe, and prosperous, and therefore happy? If their happiness matters, doesn't yours? Anyway, I added, studies show that happier people are more likely to help other people. They're more interested in social problems. They do more volunteer work and contribute more to charity. Plus, as you'd expect, they're less preoccupied with their personal problems. So being happy actually makes you more likely to work for the environment or whatever. He laughed derisively, and I decided that the proper Happiness Project response was to change the subject rather than get in an argument. Nevertheless, he'd raised the most serious criticism of happiness. It's not right to be happy when there is so much suffering in the world. Refusing to be happy because someone else is unhappy, though, is a bit like cleaning your plate because babies are starving in India. Your unhappiness isn't making anyone else happier. In fact, quite the opposite, given the fact that happier people are more likely to act altruistically. That's the circle of the second splendid truth. One of the best ways to make yourself happy is to make other people happy. One of the best ways to make other people happy is to be happy yourself. Some people associate happiness with a lack of intellectual rigor, like the man who said to Samuel Johnson, "You are a philosopher, Dr. Johnson. I have tried too in my time to be a philosopher, but I don't know how. Cheerfulness was always breaking in." Creativity, authenticity, or discernment, some folks argue, is incompatible with the bourgeois complacency of happiness. But although somber, pessimistic people might seem smarter, research shows that happiness and intelligence are essentially unrelated. Of course, it's cooler not to be too happy. There's a goofiness to happiness, an innocence, a readiness to be pleased. Zest and enthusiasm take energy, humility, and engagement. Taking refuge in irony, exercising destructive criticism, or assuming an air of philosophical ennui is less taxing. Also, irony and world weariness allow people a level of detachment from their choices. Fast food, a country club membership, a gas-guzzling SUV, reality TV. I met someone who couldn't stop talking about the stupidity of celebrities and people who read celebrity gossip, but her disdainful remarks revealed that she herself followed it very closely. I had to bite my tongue not to quote Samuel Johnson's observation of Alexander Pope. Pope's scorn of the great is too often repeated to be real. No man thinks much of that which he despises. Ironic commentary was her strategy both to embrace and to disavow celebrity gossip. Other people cultivate unhappiness as a way to control others. They cling to unhappiness because without it, they'd forgo the special consideration that unhappiness secures, the claim to pity and attention. I know I've pled unhappiness to get points for something. For example, if Jamie asks me to go to a business dinner with him and I honestly tell him, "I don't want to go. I really don't want to go, but I will if you want me to," I feel as if I get more gold stars from him than if I fibbed, "I'm happy to go. I'm really looking forward to it." If I didn't complain, if I didn't express my unhappiness, Jamie might take my complacence for granted. Some people exploit unhappiness for decades. My mother always made a big point that she'd sacrificed completing her PhD program to stay home with me and my brother, a friend told me. She was frustrated and angry, and she brought it up all the time. She used her unhappiness to control us and my father. We all felt guilty. The belief that unhappiness is selfless and happiness is selfish is misguided. It's more selfless to act happy. It takes energy, generosity, and discipline to be unfailingly lighthearted. Yet everyone takes the happy person for granted. No one is careful of his feelings or tries to keep his spirits high. He seems self-sufficient. He becomes a cushion for others. And because happiness seems unforced, that person usually gets no credit. Thérèse didn't get credit, even from her fellow nuns, for her tremendous efforts. Because she seemed so happy, they assumed that her behavior was effortless. I know a fortunate few people, such as my father, who seem naturally sunny-tempered. Now I wonder how effortless this really is. There's yet another group of people who have a superstitious dread of admitting to happiness, for fear of tempting fate. Apparently, This is practically a universal human instinct and seen in nearly all cultures, the dread of invoking cosmic anger by calling attention to good fortune. This feeling haunted me as I worked on my happiness project. By directing attention at my happiness, was I somehow putting it at risk? There's the related superstition that if you anticipate trouble and tragedy, you'll somehow forestall it. Fear and worry can be useful, because thinking about unpleasant consequences can prompt prudent actions, such as wearing a seatbelt or exercising. But for many people, fear of what might happen is a source of great unhappiness. Yet they feel there's a propitiatory virtue in fretting. For example, on some level, I feel guilty about not worrying more about Jamie's hepatitis C. I keep track of every piece of information we get. I go to many of Jamie's appointments. I've learned a lot about hepatitis C. But when it isn't an active issue in our lives, I don't think much about it. And sometimes my detachment seems irresponsible. Shouldn't I be more concerned? But my worry won't change the reality of Jamie's liver. Whipping myself up into a frenzy of fear, however, would make both Jamie and me unhappy. On the other hand, some believe that if you allow yourself to be unhappy, terrible things will happen, most likely cancer. This kind of thinking isn't new. During the Great Plague of London in 1665, for example, people believed that staying cheerful would ward off infection. Last, some people are unhappy because they won't take the trouble to be happy. Happiness takes energy and discipline. It is easy to be heavy, etc. People who are stuck in an unhappy state are pitiable. Surely they feel trapped, with no sense of having a choice in how they feel. Although their unhappiness is a drag on those around them, emotional contagion, unfortunately, operates more powerfully for negative emotions than for positive emotions, they suffer too. Philosophers, scientists, saints, and charlatans all give instruction on how to be happy, but this doesn't matter to a person who doesn't want to be happy. If you don't believe you're happy, you're not. As Publius Syrus observed, no man is happy who does not think himself so. If you think you're happy, you are. That's why Thérèse said, I take care to appear happy, and especially to be so. One of the key underlying purposes of this month's resolutions, and my entire happiness project, was to be able to bear up courageously when the phone rang with bad news, as inevitably it would. Well, bad news did come, right at the end of the month. My mother called. Have you talked to Elizabeth? She asked. No, not for about a week, I answered. What's up? Well, she has diabetes. Diabetes? Yes. Type 2, they think, but they're not sure. It's lucky they diagnosed her when they did. Her blood sugar level was dangerously high. How did she figure it out? What happens now? Why did she get it? Every random thing I knew about diabetes began zipping through my mind. The responsiveness of type 2 to changes in diet and behavior, the tensions that had arisen in the diabetes community between advocates for type 1 and type 2 over allocation of research money, memories from sixth grade when I watched my friend injecting herself in her stomach with insulin. My mother told me what she knew. Then I called my sister to hear her tell the story over again. Over the next several weeks, the news kept changing. At first, the doctors thought Elizabeth had type 2, even though she doesn't fit the usual profile. She's young, thin, fit. That diagnosis was a blow, but two things cushioned it. First, she'd been feeling lousy, and getting her blood sugar under control made her feel much better. Also, we were relieved that she didn't have type 1, which requires daily insulin and can't be alleviated by diet and exercise. Well, it turned out she did have type 1. When people are faced with serious setbacks, a psychological mechanism kicks in to help them see positive aspects in the situation, and I could feel myself starting to search for opportunities for post-traumatic growth. With various resolutions ringing in my ears, I tried to keep perspective and feel gratitude. It's so lucky they caught it when they did, I told Elizabeth. You'll be eating well and exercising regularly. You'll get this under control. You'll get used to it, and you'll do great. Elizabeth deployed the downward comparison strategy. Yes, she said, and think about all the other things it could have been. The diagnosis could have been so much worse. Diabetes really is manageable. What she didn't say, and I didn't say, was that sure, it could have been a lot worse, but it also could have been nothing at all. After college, my roommate was in a bad car accident, and I flew out to Hawaii to see her. She was wearing a halo brace with bolts drilled into her skull. "Do you feel lucky to be alive?" I asked her. "Well, actually," she said, "I feel like I really wish I hadn't been in a damn car crash." It's not easy to stay focused on the positive, but I think that my resolutions did help me cope with this news. What if I'd been the one diagnosed with diabetes? I think they would have helped even more. A common 18th century epitaph reads, "Remember, friends, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you must be. Prepare yourself to follow me." A true happiness project sentiment. Now, I kept reminding myself, is the time to keep my resolutions, because the telephone is going to ring again. Chapter 9, September. Pursue a passion. Books. Write a novel. Make time. Forget about results. Master a new technology. Returning from vacation made me appreciate my beloved library anew. This library, just one block from my apartment, is perfect. A beautiful building, open stacks, internet access, a terrific children's section, and a quiet study room in which to do my writing. And boy, is that room quiet. I still remember the glares I got one morning when I forgot to mute the startup tones on my laptop. It was easy to take the library for granted. I'd been going there several times a week for 7 years, but my brief absence reminded me how much I loved it, thus proving the advice of happiness experts who advocate periods of deprivation to sharpen pleasures. Given my happiness to be back at the library, and also September's association with the beginning of the school year, it was appropriate that this month revolve around books. My chief resolution for the month was to pursue a passion, which in my case meant everything related to books. I love reading and writing, and my work centers on reading and writing, yet these activities still get crowded out of my time. Long ago, I read the writer Dorothea Brandy's warning that writers are too inclined to spend their time on wordy occupations, like reading, talking, and watching TV, movies, and plays. Instead, she suggested, writers should recharge themselves with language-free occupations like listening to music, visiting museums, playing solitaire, or taking long walks alone. That made sense to me, and I'd sporadically tried to follow that advice. But during the period when I was preparing for my happiness project, while browsing in a bookstore, I had a glaringly obvious realization. For better or worse, what I loved to do was to read, to write, and to make books. Really, if I was honest, to the exclusion of practically any other activity. A while back, a friend with 3 children mentioned to me, "On the weekends, I like a day when we all spend at least 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon playing outside." "On the weekends," I answered, "I like a day when we all lie around reading in our pajamas until after lunch." True, but I felt bad about it. Why? Why did I think her inclinations were superior? Why do I feel guilty for lying around just reading? Probably because that's what comes most naturally to me. I wish I were different, that I had a wider range of interests, but I don't. Now, though, it was time to be more thoughtful about pursuing my passion for reading and writing. To me, that sounded like a lot more fun than playing outside. Of course, until Eleanor was older, mornings spent reading would be pure fantasy, but we'd had them before, and we'd have them again. To keep this month's resolution to pursue a passion, I first had to recognize my passion. Done. My next step was to make time for it, to find ways to integrate my passion into my ordinary days, and to stop measuring myself against some irrelevant standard of efficiency. I also wanted to learn to master some of the new technology that makes bookmaking easy. Not everyone shares my particular passion, of course. Instead of books, it might be college football, or community theater, or politics, or garage sales. But whatever your passion might be, happiness research predicts that making time for a passion and treating it as a real priority instead of an extra to be fitted in at a free moment, which many people practically never have, will bring a tremendous happiness boost. One thing I learned from my blog, however, was that some people feel overwhelmed by the question, what's your passion? It seems so large and unanswerable that they feel paralyzed. If so, a useful clue to finding a passion to pursue, whether for work or play, is to do what you do. What you enjoyed doing as a 10-year-old, or choose to do on a free Saturday afternoon, is a strong indication of your passion. One blog reader pointed to an even more basic indicator, actually very similar to advice from a physics professor of mine, who said, what do you think about when you're sitting on the toilet? Because that's what you want to think about. Do what you do is helpful because it points you to examining your behavior rather than your self-conception, and therefore may be a clearer guide to your preferences. Write a novel. My most ambitious project for the month was to write a novel in 30 days. I'd never had the urge to run marathons or climb mountains, but the thought of completing a novel in a month filled me with the same kind of lust for the thrill of exertion. I wanted to find out whether I could do it. A while back, when I'd run into an acquaintance on the street, she'd mentioned that she was writing a novel in a month. You are? I asked, immediately intrigued. How? I got this book, No Plot, No Problem, by Chris Beatty. You start without any preparation, you don't edit yourself, and by writing 1,667 words a day, you write a 50,000-word novel in 30 days. 50,000 words, I asked. Is that long enough to be a real novel? That's as long as The Catcher in the Rye or The Great Gatsby. Really? You know, I said slowly, I might try it too. He also started National Novel Writing Month. That's in November. Lots of people all over the country do it. We were standing on a street corner one block from the Barnes & Noble at Union Square. I'm going to buy the book right now, I said, making up my mind. I really am going to think about it. I bought the book, and I came up with an idea. Two people having an affair in Manhattan. I'd been reading Lori Colwin, Roxana Robinson, and other novelists writing about the problems of middle marriage, and I wanted to think about the happiness and unhappiness consequences of a middle marriage crisis like an affair. Also, I thought it would be fun to try to think through the logistics of how two people in the same social circle would keep their affair a secret, and to write about New York City. On the first day of September, I typed happiness on the title page and wrote my first sentence. When she thought about it later, Emily realized that she knew exactly when her affair with Michael Harmon had its start. About 8 p.m. on the night of September 18th, at a cocktail party at Lisa and Andrew Kessel's apartment. And so on, for 1,667 words. Writing the novel was a lot of work, but I had less trouble squeezing the writing into my day than I'd expected. Of course, I had it easier than most people, since I was already a full-time writer. But even so, I had to scrimp on time otherwise spent reading newspapers and magazines, meeting people for coffee, reading for fun, or generally puttering around. My blog posts became noticeably shorter. After the first 10 days, I ran into a problem. I'd reached the end of my plot. I hadn't thought of much action. Emily and Michael have lunch. They start an affair. They end their affair. And I'd already written most of that story before I'd hit even 25,000 words. Beatty's book promised that I wouldn't have trouble coming up with more story. And somehow, I kept going and going. Each day, one way or another, I managed to eke out the minimum word requirement until on September 30th, I typed the sentence, she'd do her shopping at a different drugstore. The end. I calculated the word count, 50,163 words. I'd finished a novel that was long enough to be a real book, as long as some of my favorite novels, like Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood and Chuck Palahniuk's Fight Club. It was a huge amount of work, plunked on top of everything else I needed to accomplish in my days. Did it make me happy? It sure did. Writing happiness took a lot of time and energy, it's true, but it gave me a substantial boost in happiness. Tackling such a big project and carrying it through to the end in a single month contributed hugely to the atmosphere of growth in my life. It was thrilling to see what I could accomplish in a short time if I put my mind to it. Also, because I was always searching for material that could enrich the story, the world came alive to me in a new way. On my way home from the library one afternoon, I saw a large crowd milling around in front of the famous Frank E. Campbell Funeral Chapel. This would make a great scene for my novel, I thought. But perhaps the most acute source of happiness from writing was the happiness of expressing a very complicated idea, the kind of idea that takes hundreds of pages to capture. I remember the precise moment when the idea struck me. I'd been at a dinner party with several couples who lived in my neighborhood. I'd seen two of my friends engaged in an intense, surely innocent, conversation, and I'd thought, what if they were having an affair? How could they pull it off? What would happen? Always before, it had taken me years to write books that I'd envisioned. This novel might not be very good, but I'd completed it in 1 month. As I'd seen in February with Extreme Nice, the boot camp approach has many advantages. The brilliant Scott McCloud suggests a similar exercise, the 24-hour comic, in his book, Making Comics. Draw an entire 24-page comic book in a single 24-hour period. No script. No preparation. Great shock therapy for the creatively blocked. The boot camp approach also gave me a sense of creative freedom, because I realized that when I had the uncontrollable urge to write a novel, a little disgust but widespread occupational hazard that affects many writers, I could just sit down and do it. And to my surprise, writing happiness was fun. Usually when I'm writing, I constantly question my work. With novel writing month, I couldn't take the time, and it was a relief to be free from my inner critic. As one friend told me, face it, your novel is probably terrible, but that's okay. This project helped me to keep my March resolution to enjoy the fun of failure. After I'd written the 50,163rd word, I was immediately itching to go back and edit it. But I resisted. I didn't even reread it. At some point, I will. Writing a novel provided the atmosphere of growth that, I was becoming more and more convinced, was essential to happiness. I'd included this element in my first splendid truth, but it was even more significant than I'd initially understood. The satisfaction gained from the achievement of a large undertaking is one of the most substantial that life affords. When I asked blog readers if tackling a big goal had ever brought them happiness, many people wrote to share their own experiences. I took on a big commitment and surprised myself by completing it. I joined a YouTube group called the 100 Day Reality Challenge. I made a video blog every day for 100 days. I'd never made videos for YouTube before, but I had a camera that took movies. I set up the commitment to make me focus on something positive and share it every day. Doing a video every day was probably easier than just once a week, just because it was a daily habit. Although the challenge was really about something called the law of attraction, which I didn't myself manage to attract, I did find myself happier from having fun making the videos to making new friends through all the comments. I decided this would be the year I would train to do a sprint triathlon. I joined a team, worked out nearly every day for 8 weeks, and after I completed the triathlon, I signed up to do a second one. I am typically a person who lies in bed and reads, but I always thought it would be good to do a try before I turned 40, 2 years away. It was terrific training, and I'd highly recommend doing a sprint triathlon if it's something anyone's ever thought about doing. I am learning Italian in less than 7 months. I was given the opportunity to do so, and I took it. I knew absolutely no Italian when I began the course, and just under 7 months from the start date, I will be fluent. I am only partway through, and I can already have conversations with native speakers. It's a huge undertaking, and I have almost quit many times, but it is wonderful and fun, too. After coming out of depression, I built my own wooden dinghy in about 6 weeks. I did it both as a symbol of victory and as part of the process. It made me very happy to finish, and the few times I had it on the water were all memorable experiences. In addition, owning the dinghy made me join a sailing club, which gives me access to a beautiful and peaceful sight and brings me into contact with interesting people. All of this increases my happiness. I am writing a memoir. I started working part-time as a nurse so I could focus more on the writing, and I'm very happy doing this. I would say I'm about halfway through the manuscript. What galvanized me into doing this was a life-altering illness that I went through. I spent months on crutches, not knowing if I would ever walk again. Permanent disability was a real possibility. After you go through something like that, through a quagmire of despair, you let go of a lot. And you realize, experientially, that life is way too short not to follow your passion. So, that's what I do these days. As I'm growing up, I'm learning how important doing what you love is to your happiness. My big goal is to find a way to make money doing what I love. I'm 22 and 2 years into the corporate world, but my passion is designing and making jewelry. I'm starting small, making custom jewelry for family and friends, and I just launched an online shop at Etsy.com. I've loved designing jewelry for a while, but only recently have I gotten the courage to truly chase after my passion. Although I'm nowhere near having a viable business, I hope to eventually. Sometimes it gets frustrating to see that my goal is just a tiny seed right now, but having a vision of what I want it to become keeps me motivated to just go for it without giving up. Working hard for something that you are passionate about is so satisfying and adds so much genuine happiness to life. You might experiment with new recipes, go camping in your 15th state park, plan a 60th birthday party, or watch your favorite team progress to the Super Bowl. I liked writing a novel. Make time. Although reading was one of my most important priorities and certainly one of my greatest pleasures, I never really gave it much thought. I wanted to make more time to read, more books with more enjoyment. To do so, I gave myself permission to read at whim. Samuel Johnson observed, "If we read without inclination, half the mind is employed in fixing the attention, so there is but one half to be employed on what we read." Science backs this up. When researchers tried to figure out what helped third and fourth graders remember what they read, they found that the student's interest in a passage was far more important than the readability of the passage. 30 times more important. So between the books I read for happiness research, such as Jonathan Haidt's The Happiness Hypothesis, Anne Lamott's Plan B, and some biographies of Tolstoy, I threw in Leslie Lewis's The Private Life of a Country House, 1912 to 1939. Along the same lines, I let myself reread William Makepeace Thackeray's Vanity Fair, Charlotte Yonge's The Heir of Redcliffe, and Laura Ingalls Wilder whenever I had the urge, instead of steering myself to read something new. I've always thought that the best reading is rereading. I pushed myself to keep reading lists. I asked people for recommendations. As a side benefit, this turned out to be a relationship booster. People responded warmly when I wrote down their suggestions. On the advice of a fellow member of the Children's Literature Book Group, I subscribed to Slightly Foxed, a charming British quarterly that publishes people's essays about their favorite books. And I noted suggestions from the magazine The Week's The Book List section. But the main hurdle keeping me from reading more wasn't the problem of figuring out what to read, but rather having enough time to read. No matter how much time I spent reading, I wanted more. Of course, whenever anyone complains of not having enough time, the first suggestion is always watch less TV. Which makes sense. The average American spends between 4 and 5 hours watching TV each day. "Do you think we watch too much TV?" I asked Jamie. "We hardly watch any TV," he said. "Well, we do watch some. What do you think? 5 or 6 hours a week? But we only watch what we've TiVo'd or from a DVD." "I don't think we should give up all TV," he said. "TV is great, if you're not watching in a stupid way." He was right. It was fun to watch a show once the girls were asleep. Watching TV seemed more companionable than reading in the same room. I suppose the fact that we were sharing the same experience made it seem cozier. I did, however, vow to stop reading books that I didn't enjoy. I used to pride myself on finishing every book I started. No longer. And just as I used to make myself finish every book, I used to keep every book I bought, and we had messy stacks on every surface of our house. I culled ruthlessly, and we dropped off several heavy bags of books at a thrift store. I also accepted my idiosyncratic reluctance to read any book or see any play or movie that centers on the theme of unjust accusation. I was never going to be able to force myself to read Oliver Twist, Othello, To Kill a Mockingbird, Atonement, A Passage to India, Burmese Days, Crime and Punishment, or Arthur and George if I could avoid it. And that was okay. Forget about results. As I read, I love to take notes, often for no apparent reason. I'm always marking up books, making odd lists, gathering examples in strange categories, copying passages. For some reason, I like working on some permanent, undefined research project. I feel compelled to make lists of foreign words that describe concepts that English can't convey. Flâneur, darshan, eudaimonia, ame, nostalgie de la boue, explanations of concepts that I find queerly charged with significance. The Fisher King, the Westerly Road, Croatoan, Eleusinian Mysteries, Offering of First Fruits, The Hunting of the Wren, The Corn Spirit, Sparrow Moss, The Lord of Misrule, Cargo Cult, Greek Herm, Potlatch, The Golden Ratio, and hundreds of other topics. Note-taking takes a lot of time and energy, and I used to discourage this impulse in myself. It seemed pointless and self-indulgent. But following this month's resolutions and my first commandment to be Gretchen, I allowed myself to forget about results and take notes guilt-free. Perversely, it was only once I said to myself, "Okay, Gretchen, take all the notes you want, it doesn't matter why," that it occurred to me how useful these notes had been. My first book, Power, Money, Fame, Sex, grew out of a huge body of notes. When I had a chance to write my book, Profane Waste, about the question of why people would choose to destroy their own possessions, I was able to pack the book with startling, apt examples because I'd been taking notes, for no discernible reason, for years. Because note-taking didn't look like real work to me, it didn't register as valuable, even though it was. One thing that makes a passion enjoyable is that you don't have to worry about results. You can strive for triumph, or you can potter around, tinker, explore, without worrying about efficiency or outcomes. Other people may wonder why you've been happy to work on the same old car for years, even though it's still not running, but that doesn't matter to you. An atmosphere of growth brings great happiness, but at the same time, happiness sometimes also comes when you're free from the pressure to see much growth. That's not surprising. Often, the opposite of a great truth is also true. Master a new technology. To me, making books sounded like fun. As a child, I'd spent countless hours working on my blank books. I'd written two horrible novels before I became a professional writer. Throughout my life, I'd made mini book projects as gifts for my family and friends. When I thought about the projects that I'd loved doing with Eliza, they all involved making books. For example, she and I made a book using some of her bright, elaborate drawings. She dictated a caption for each picture while I typed. Then we cut out the captions, taped them on the pictures, made color copies, and had the copies spiral bound into a book. It was a fun project to work on, made a wonderful keepsake, supplied a Christmas/Hanukkah gift for the grandparents, captured a moment in Eliza's development, and allowed me to throw away the enormous stacks of pictures without a smidgen of guilt. However, I will admit that when I wrote about this project on my blog, one reader was shocked. "I can't believe you actually threw out the originals of your daughter's drawings. I would have made the copies, as you did, but bound the originals into a scrapbook of sorts. The originals can never be duplicated. I must confess to actually gasping when I read this." Recently, I'd been intrigued to read about a self-publishing site, Lulu.com. According to the website, I could print a proper hardback book, complete with dust jacket, for less than $30. I mentioned this to Jamie, and he snorted, "What would anyone use that for?" You mean who has book-length documents lying around that they'd like to print in book form? I asked. Right. Are you kidding? Me, I said. If this works, I'll print up a dozen. At last, something to do with all those notes I'd been taking without a purpose. For the trial run, I made a book out of the journal I'd kept for the first 18 months of Eliza's life, another book I'd written without really noticing it. I sat down at the computer, preparing to put myself in jail to cope with my frustration and my desire to rush. Instead, the whole process took about 20 minutes. When my self-published book arrived a few weeks later, it exceeded my wildest expectations. There was my baby journal, as a real book. What next? I did a book of my favorite quotations about the nature of biography. I did a book of my favorite uncategorized quotations, and I fantasized about future books. When I finished my research on happiness, I'd print out a book of my favorite happiness quotations. Maybe I could even include photo illustrations. I'd make a book of my blog posts. I'd print out my novel, Happiness. I'd print up my one-sentence journal. I could even make copies for the girls. Plus, I had so many ideas for great happiness-related books. If I couldn't publish them with a real publisher, I would publish them myself. I also learned that through Shutterfly, an online photo service site, I could print a hardback photo album. Figuring out how to do this turned out to be challenging, but eventually I mastered it, and once I was done, I ordered a copy for us and the grandparents, and everyone received a neat organized book stuffed with photos. Although it was expensive, I reminded myself that not only was I keeping my resolution to master a new technology, I was also keeping my resolutions to make purchases that will further my goals, indulge in a modest splurge, and be a treasure house of happy memories. And once I got through the painful learning curve, it was fun. The novelty and challenge of mastering the technology, though I was maddened with frustration at times, did give me enormous satisfaction. And it gave me a new way to pursue my passion for books. Of all the months so far, September's resolutions had been the most pleasant and easiest to maintain. This showed me, once again, that I was happier when I accepted my own real likes and dislikes instead of trying to decide what I ought to like. I was happier when I stopped squelching the inclinations towards note-taking and bookmaking that I'd had since childhood and instead embraced them. As Michel de Montaigne observed, the least strained and most natural ways of the soul are the most beautiful. The best occupations are the least forced. I needed to accept my own nature, yet I needed to push myself as well. This seemed contradictory, but in my heart, I knew the difference between lack of interest and fear of failure. I'd seen this in March with my blog. Although I'd been nervous about launching a blog, I did recognize that running a blog is the kind of thing I would like to do. In fact, I realized, my work on my childhood blank books, where I had pulled together interesting information, copied quotations, and matched text with striking images, sounded an awful lot like posting to my blog. Sheesh. In fact, once I realized that, I decided to give up working on my new blank book. I'd had fun working on it since May. And I'd gotten a nostalgic kick from resuming an activity that had given me so much pleasure in childhood. But I'd outgrown it. My blog had taken its place as an outlet to record the odds and ends I felt compelled to gather. On the very last day of the month, I had an important realization. My fourth splendid truth. Jamie and I were having dinner with a guy we knew slightly. He asked me what I was working on. And after I described the happiness project, he said, in polite disagreement, that he himself subscribed to John Stuart Mill's view. And he gave the precise quotation from Mill. I was impressed. Ask yourself whether you are happy, and you cease to be so. One of the problems of thinking about happiness all the time is that I've developed rather decided views. I wanted to pound the table and yell, no, no, no. Instead, I managed to nod and say in a mild voice, yes, a lot of people take that view. I can't say that I agree. I could see it in the guy's face. John Stuart Mill versus Gretchen Rubin. Who's more likely to be right? But in my experience, at least, thinking about happiness had made me far happier than I was before I gave happiness much consideration. Now, Mill may have been referring to the state of flow identified by the researcher Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. In flow, it's true. People are completely absorbed, so focused on their tasks that they forget themselves at the perfect balance of challenge and skill. But I think that Mill meant, or people generally believe, that thinking about your happiness makes you self-absorbed. You're not thinking about other people, work, or anything other than your own satisfaction. Or perhaps Mill meant that happiness comes as a consequence of pursuing other goals, such as love and work, and shouldn't be a goal in itself. Of course it's not enough to sit around wanting to be happy. You must make the effort to take steps towards happiness by acting with more love, finding work you enjoy, and all the rest. But for me, asking myself whether I was happy had been a crucial step toward cultivating my happiness more wisely through my actions. Also, only through recognizing my happiness did I really appreciate it. Happiness depends partly on external circumstances, and it also depends on how you view those circumstances. I'd thought about this question many times during the course of the year, but finally it hit me that this was my fourth splendid truth. You're not happy unless you think you're happy. Then it struck me that the fourth splendid truth has a corollary. You're happy if you think you're happy. And that means thinking about happiness, no matter what John Stuart Mill said. Chapter 10. October. Pay attention. Mindfulness. Meditate on koans. Examine true rules. Stimulate the mind in new ways. Keep a food diary. When I told people I was working on a book about happiness, the single most common response was, "You should spend some time studying Buddhism." A close second was, "So are you drinking a bottle of wine every night?" The Dalai Lama's The Art of Happiness was the book most often recommended to me. I'd always been intrigued by Buddhism, so I was eager to learn more about both the religion and the life of the Buddha. But although I admired many of its teachings, I didn't feel much connection to Buddhism, which, at its heart, urges detachment as a way to alleviate suffering. Although there is a place for love and commitment, these bonds are considered fetters that bind us to lives of sorrow, which, of course, they do. Instead, I'm an adherent of the Western tradition of cultivating deep passions and profound attachments. I didn't want to detach. I wanted to embrace. I didn't want to loosen. I wanted to deepen. Also, the Western tradition emphasizes the expression and the perfection of each unique individual soul. Not so in the Eastern tradition. Nevertheless, studying Buddhism made me realize the significance of some concepts that I'd overlooked. The most important was mindfulness, the cultivation of conscious, non-judgmental awareness. I have several tendencies that run counter to mindfulness. I constantly multitask in ways that pull me away from my present experience. I often run on automatic pilot, arriving home with no recollection of having gone from point A to point B. This sometimes terrifies me when I'm driving. I have no recollection of watching the road. I tend to dwell on anxieties or hopes for the future instead of staying fully aware in the present moment. I often break or spill things because I'm not paying attention. When I'm introduced to someone in a social situation, I often forget the person's name as soon as I hear it. I finish eating before I've even registered the taste of my food. In September, a jarring experience had reminded me of the importance of mindfulness. After a pleasant family weekend, spent mostly going to children's birthday parties, 3 in 2 days, I was walking down the hallway after putting both girls to bed. All of a sudden, as I headed to my desk to check my emails, I had the sensation that I was zooming back into my body. It was as if I had just returned from a 2-week trip away from myself. The very hallway in which I stood seemed unfamiliar, yet I'd been living my ordinary life the whole time. It was very, very unnerving. If I was just getting back home, where had I been? I needed to do a better job of staying in the moment. Mindfulness brings many benefits. Scientists point out that it calms the mind and elevates brain function. It gives clarity and vividness to present experience. It may help people break unhealthy habits, and it can soothe troubled spirits and lift people's moods. It reduces stress and chronic pain. It makes people happier, less defensive, and more engaged with others. One highly effective way to practice mindfulness is through meditation, which is recommended by